The Tom Woods Show, episode 2075.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're like me, when you criticize the Federal Reserve, you get all these lackey-style responses. Why, the Fed has made the economy more stable. You don't want to go back to the 19th century, do you? All kinds of arguments like that. Well, you can blow those and others out of the water with my free ebook, Our Enemy, the Fed. Grab it at ourenemythefed.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here, talking today about the future of privacy, the future of money, in the wake of what's been going on in the world, particularly with the Canadian truckers, but not limited to them. And we're going to have this conversation with our old friend Naomi Brockwell, who 1 year back when Bob Murphy and I used to host the Contra Cruise was one of our special guests, and she just couldn't have been more outstanding. Naomi is an award-winning producer who hosts some of the largest blockchain and economics conferences around the world. She interviews the biggest names in tech, business, and politics. Her channel, NBTV, has been producing videos on blockchain, tech, and privacy since 2013. She is co-founder of the Soho Forum, the debate society we hear so much about from our friend Gene Epstein. Now, let me point out, by the way, that when I recorded this interview late last week with her, I had a cold, and it was a cold that just came and went. It was just gone almost as soon as it came. But my voice is going to sound like this, and it's going to seem a little bit different from my voice now. The voice of Woods in perfect health. So I just wanted to let you know in case you're trying to adjust your dial. Problem is on my end, but the problem is since resolved. All right, here we go with my interview with Naomi Brockwell. I'm so glad you emailed me because this really is the perfect time to talk to you. It seems like it's been forever. And I'm so, you know, as they say, when you see somebody at a funeral, I'm sorry we have to meet under these circumstances, but I'm sorry the events of the world have brought you back to the Tom Woods Show. But all the same, that is a silver lining.
No, I feel like that's the story of my life. It's me coming to people when there's a disaster and saying, hey guys, there is hope. Sorry about the disaster, by the way.
That's right. That's right. But on the other hand, that's not a bad role to play in the world, is it? So let's talk about the circumstances here. I mean, of course, in the news is Ukraine, of course, and Ukraine and Russia is what everybody's talking about. And just before that in the news was Canada and Justin Trudeau and what was done to the trucker protest. And what these things have highlighted is the need for a couple of things. Number one, and we'll get to this later, but privacy, I mean, ways to communicate with each other that can't be hacked or listened into. But also, and I've been talking about this a number of times over the past couple of weeks, a money that you don't need the state for, that the separation of money and state is what you need. Because if the state is running the money, the state can intervene in the banking system. The banking system is regulated by the state. You want to be able to get around this. And we've been talking about this for a while. And yet, you know, I think the average person never thought this would really matter. And now suddenly a lot of people, if you were to say to them, we need some kind of non-state alternative when it comes to money, instead of saying, wow, that's the most radical, absurd, ridiculous thing I've ever heard, I think at this point you'd have millions of people nodding their heads.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. And I've seen, you know, previously there were a lot of detractors in crypto who are saying like, what is even the point? You know, my Visa card works way better than this crazy internet money. Why would I ever need this thing? And now they're looking at Canada was the real catalyst for these realizations. They're looking at Canada, they're looking at the financial blockades and saying, oh, I get it. You need something that isn't part of the existing financial rails. You need something that's not controllable by governments, something that's decentralized, something that you have complete ownership of, and you don't need to ask someone's permission in order to use it. And that was a really big moment of revelation for a lot of people. You know, they forget about all the price speculation that goes on where they're like, this is going to go to zero, or this is going to go to $1 million. You know, that's not the point here. The value proposition of Bitcoin is that it is a way to transfer value and it's uncensorable. So it's really, I mean, it's hitting home right now with what's going on in the Ukraine and the bank runs and what's going on in Canada with financial blockades. A lot of people are starting to get it now.
All right. What can we say, though, about the intersection of these two things, about cryptocurrency and privacy? Some people are saying that, well, Bitcoin isn't nearly as private as some people have sold it as. So is it really the ideal cryptocurrency?
So that's a great point. I think that Bitcoin, I mean, You talk to some of the OG people in the crypto space. Scott Stornett is one of my favorite. He was the inventor of like the early blockchain, which is this protocol that underlies Bitcoin technology. So he says that Bitcoin was the first decentralized digital money to get the ball over the net, right? And that was an amazing achievement because they were trying for a really long time to create a money that couldn't be controlled by government. But it was just the first one to get that ball over the net. And now we've had so much innovation, especially in privacy. I mean, you look at something like Zcash, where they're really at the cutting edge of privacy. But you're absolutely right, Tom. I mean, I love Bitcoin. I love it that it's evolved as sort of this inflation hedge, as sort of this place to store your assets if you don't want to get hit by inflation or monetary controls. Like there's a lot of value there. But if it's not fungible, you know, if it's not, if $1 isn't equal to another dollar, if they're identifiable dollars, you know, you open the door for sanctions and censorship and all that outside of the protocol itself. So privacy coins definitely do, you know, take the baton here and run with it. And you've just seen incredible innovation where you have these truly completely private currencies now that are digital and they can't be identified either. So I think that we've definitely moved ahead light years in that respect.
Well, can you now explain for the layman what it means to hold something like Bitcoin on an exchange like Coinbase, as opposed to not holding it on an exchange, and explain just basically what private keys and wallets, what some of this terminology means?
Absolutely. So when you put your money in Chase bank account, you're giving them your money and they're controlling that money. They're what's called the custodian of that money. And Chase is a custodial service. So every time you want to access your US dollars, you ask Chase, can I have permission to move these funds? And then they move it on your behalf. And you have the similar entities in crypto. You have these crypto banks, you know, like Coinbase, you have exchanges, and they custody your money. You give them your crypto, and every time you want to move it, you ask their permission, they move it on your behalf. What's happening under the hood there is basically, I mean, this gets a little into the weeds, so I'll try to be as simple as possible. So in order to access your crypto isn't technically in those banks. Your crypto exists on a blockchain, right? It's this digital entity. And in order for you to have access to move the funds in that digital entity, you control a private key. Now, when you have a custodian, like one of these crypto banks, they hold the private key. Now, when you hold your own money in a wallet, you hold the private key. You have control of that. No one else has access to it. And that's really the key, right? Whoever has control of the private key is the only one who can move those funds on the blockchain. So it's a really, really powerful thing to be in possession of. And what's going on around the world right now is a lot of people, I mean, they might have their money in bank accounts, they might have their money in crypto banks. If anyone else is custodying those funds for them, these people have to ask permission to get access to their own money. And when you're in a desperate situation, when you've been called a dissident or a terrorist, or you have an invading force or whatever is going on, and you have to take the time to ask permission to get access to your own money, I mean, it's a terribly dire situation. And a lot of the time you may be rejected. What happened in Canada was Trudeau said, actually, anyone who's even donated to someone who's part of this freedom convoy, you are going to be sanctioned. You have your accounts frozen. You may be arrested. I mean, it was a terrible situation. So you have people who are just like, oh, well, this seems like a cause I want to support. They're sending some money over. Suddenly they have their entire bank account frozen. They can't pay their bills. So if they were controlling their own money in a wallet, so meaning they have control of that private key, and it sounds very complicated, but in reality, it's not really. It's just the same as using any, you know, banking app on your phone, you know, they would be able to keep paying those bills and they would be able to use their money however they see fit, because there's no one who can censor that. There's no intermediary for the governments to pressure. It's just you using your money, sending it directly to whoever you want to receive it. So it's an incredibly powerful tool.
I find that most people who are really, really committed to Bitcoin in particular want to go out of their way to let me know that they do not use a service like Coinbase, that they feel like half the point of being involved in Bitcoin is defeated by having your Bitcoin on an exchange like that. On the other hand, there's convenience. There's no denying that there's a convenience to having your Bitcoin there. Do you think that ultimately it's best for people not to be on exchanges?
So it really depends what your threat model is. Right now, if you're in the Ukraine, 100%, you want to get your money out of any intermediary. If you were in Canada, honestly, you would want to get your money out of any intermediary and hold that money yourself. If you're just living your life, I mean, there's definite benefits to using a custodial service. And I'll give you an example. So, you know, I get a lot of people into crypto because I want to teach them about the powerful tool for freedom that this is. And I want to show them how easy it is to control your own money and to opt out of the traditional financial system. Because I think opting out is one of the most powerful tools we have for pushing back against government overreach. Just opt out of the system and take your assets with you. And I see a lot of people who haven't grown up with the internet, they haven't grown up with computers, and they do struggle with trying to figure out, well, what is this digital asset? What are these wallets? What is this blockchain? And so what comes along with ownership of your money is actually great responsibility. If you think about all the security mechanisms that Chase Bank has in place, where they have, you know, security and they have all these enforcers and they have a bunch of compliance people, and they're basically, if you lose your credit card, you know, you don't have to worry. They're just going to send you another one in the post, right? And so when you control your own money, you should really have systems in place that are comparable to what Chase has, right? I mean, if you're storing your own money, you want to protect it. So you want to have security in place. Now, obviously, there's not a bigger target on your back as there is on the entire Chase banking system. You know, if someone hacks Chase, then they get a lot of money. If they hack you, they only get a little bit. But even so, you want to make sure you're protecting yourself. So a lot of people, I don't think, are ready for that kind of responsibility. So I think that custodians are a great way for people to get started. But once you get started and you start to use this, you realize how easy it is. You start to learn how easy it is to actually start to, you know, look after your own assets. And it's really not a big stretch for people to then move over to non-custodial services. So I agree that that's the ultimate aim. I want to see a world where people are controlling their own funds, because as soon as you have centralized control points, they become leverage points for governments. They become places for coercion. You know, they can be coerced by government and they can freeze your funds and all kinds of things can happen. So controlling your own money is a really powerful tool. But I definitely get what you're saying about the convenience factor. And I think that people need to assess their own threat model. What are they most concerned about? Are they concerned about them losing their own password? Or are they most concerned about the government seizing their funds? And so if it's the latter, you absolutely want to be controlling your own money. And I'm really sad to say it's not completely off the table that this is a threat for more and more people now. We've seen this totalitarian slide that governments have been going towards these last couple of years, more and more authoritarian actions all across the globe. You know, lots of governments taking these heavy-handed approaches. So I think that now is a great time for people to start dipping their toes in the water, understanding what this system is, and understanding what it will take for them to control their own money.
Here's a issue I raised with our friend Saifedean the other day. I said that the problem with at least the state of the development of Bitcoin at the moment, the extent to which it's fully developed, is that I'm holding some Bitcoin and maybe a whole bunch of people sent me Bitcoin because they believe in my cause and they think this is the best or maybe the only way to get me funds. But then when I turn around to pay my expenses, my water bill, my electric bill, whatever it is, I have to get that Bitcoin back into the US dollar. And how am I going to do that in a way where the government won't catch me at that moment? Is there going to come a time when I can transact in Bitcoin, even when it comes to these types of expenses? Or are we there already, but I just need to know certain things? Or what's the status?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would say that we are already there, but but if you don't know about it, it means that it's probably not going to be that convenient for you. So I think that at the moment, I mean, I know a lot of people who are completely unbanked. They've taken all of their money out of the banking system. They're living entirely on crypto. They are paying their water bills and their electricity bills and their phone bill and buying their groceries. They're doing all of this with crypto. But there are trade-offs at the moment because, as you mentioned, it's not pervasive. We aren't all doing it. So those trade-offs mean that instead of going to their regular supermarket down the road, you know, perhaps they have to go through a different option that does accept cryptocurrency. And there are a lot now. So it means that you have to start start seeking out services that accept cryptocurrency and start using those instead of your favorite stores. So a lot of people for that reason are just opting out and saying, I'm just going to hold my crypto. I'm not even going to transfer it back into fiat. I'm just going to hold it for now until things get more pervasive. I would actually encourage people to be catalysts for this movement. We ultimately want to take that money and opt out of this financial system, right? And so we can be movements of change by asking our local grocery store, hey, will you accept crypto? I mean, you'd be surprised how many coffee shops, for example, I've onboarded and said, I started off just with the baristas, you know, will you accept a crypto tip? And they'll say, oh, interesting, you know? And so then I'll start paying their tips in crypto. And then the entire coffee shop will start accepting crypto. And there are so many places that are super eager to accept cryptocurrency. You just have to ask them. So I think that anyone who receives crypto, they want to spend it. That would be my first suggestion. Just ask your local stores if they want to try it out, if they want to accept it. And then if they say no, I think that's fine. But there are lots and lots of alternatives out there. There are lots of services. I mean, a few that I can mention. So purse.io is a way to spend crypto and buy Amazon purchases. And not only can you buy anything on Amazon using your crypto, you also get up to a 33% discount, depending on how long you're willing to wait for the order, which is huge. That's huge. Like I average about like 5 to 10% on every Amazon order because I use crypto. There's also, you know, Dash Direct. I think they have 155,000 merchants, places like Applebee's and Lowe's and all of these major chains where you can spend your Dash instead of transferring it first to fiat. BitRefill is another great one. People can buy gift cards there. They can refill their phones. There are lots of tools out there where you can be living your entire life on crypto. It's not entirely convenient yet. If you are willing to, you know, take a stand and you want to do this because you believe in the cause, you can absolutely do it right now. But I think that it's not going to be long before this is going to be completely pervasive and you can live entirely off crypto with very little inconvenience at all.
Until we get to that point, doesn't it seem like it would be nice to have a searchable website where you could find places in your area that accept it?
I mean, similar things exist. So Bitcoin.com website has a map that shows you places in the neighborhood that accept Bitcoin Cash. And then AnyPay is a payment processor that shows any place that's accepted anything through AnyPay. The problem with decentralized services is it's very hard to catalog every participant in this decentralized network.
Yeah.
And so what you have is these kind of intermediaries or businesses that will, you know, cater for just their little subset. And so you can search it, but it's definitely not going to be holistic. I agree. That would be great. I would love to be able to just type in, you know, where can I go and buy some, you know, Tim Tams for crypto or whatever.
Hey everybody, let's take just a minute to remind you that there are so many things that people can struggle with, like anxiety and depression and stress and relationship issues, and they afflict us for so long and so regularly that we come to assume that this is just part of life, that there's nothing we can do about this. This is just our fate. In fact, we're so caught in it that the very question of whether it could be avoided, whether there's anything that could be done about it, sometimes doesn't even cross our minds. Well, Woods is here to tell you that there is help in the form of our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp will figure out exactly what it is you need, match you up with a licensed professional therapist who specializes in what you need. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. You can check out the ton of testimonials on their website. And by the way, just in case they don't fix you up with your perfect therapeutic match, they'll get you another one. So many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/woods. Well, let's shift over to the related subject of privacy, because that too has become a topic that more and more people who never really gave it a second thought are now thinking about. And it's the kind of thing that my listeners are very interested in and that I have to admit I was a little bit late getting to. Like my view was, I don't know what I really need to protect. I'm so open with everything I think. It's not like you're going to discover some secret opinion I hold or something. I just tell the world already, you know? So there was a little bit of that that I feel like, well, I'm not doing anything illegal, so I don't. It didn't seem to me to be particularly urgent. And now I just feel like, well, do you know why I need privacy? And then hold up a middle finger. This is why, you know, that's why, you know, go screw yourself. That's why I want privacy. So it's funny. I have a friend who is an expert on this and who has a webinar where he walks people through some simple things they can do right away without much effort to increase their privacy and improve it. And so I sent a few emails to my people saying, hey, you might want to check out this guy's webinar. And it was just an overwhelming response with almost no effort on my part, which goes to show people are fascinated by this. So what can you tell us about this? Again, particularly with current events in mind and victimized people and marginalized mm-hmm. people, why does this matter and what are some solutions we have?
Yeah, well, I think you brought up a really great point when you said you used to think, I'm not doing anything illegal, therefore, why should I be worried? So the first thing I will say is that every single thing that you're doing on the internet, essentially, is being collected and stored forever in a permanent database associated with your real identity. And you may think again, none of it's illegal, so who really cares? Well, this data is forever. Regimes come and go. Governments go in and out of power. And social norms change, but that data is forever. So you may not be doing anything illegal today, but 10 years' time, you might have a government come into power and they're like, actually, we really don't like anyone who is promoting self-ownership. We really don't like anyone who had the ideals of self-sovereignty and we're going to persecute them. Let's look at all the people who had a podcast and who are promoting that people stand up for themselves. They have access to all of that data. And so it's a really scary proposition, not knowing what the future will hold and knowing that these societal norms will change and they may not change in your favor. And so I think people really need to be cognizant of what they're putting out on the internet and be more mindful of that. And as you said, the lucky thing is that there are really small steps that you can take that actually go a long way to protecting your privacy. And just before I dive into that, I will mention right now you're seeing, in Canada, with the financial blockades, you have people who are being called terrorists because they disagreed with what the government had to say. So they wanted to push back against their own government and they were persecuted. So for those people, I would say you should really be protecting all your communications. You shouldn't be using SMS. You shouldn't be using email. You should be using encrypted chat for all your communications. And on top of that, you should have disappearing messages set because you really don't want these sensitive topics to be available for anyone to just scoop up. Even if you're not doing anything illegal, you should really be mindful that sometimes it doesn't matter if you're doing anything illegal. Sometimes you will be targeted regardless and people will just try to find something to pin on you anyway. The same with the Ukraine right now. Look at what's going on there. You have the most popular messaging app in the Ukraine right now is Telegram. And Telegram, through an incredible marketing campaign, kind of pitches itself as this private messaging service. And it's absolutely not. So Telegram, by default, is all in plain text, or everything that you've ever sent to people, whether it's a file or a photo or a message, is stored in a cloud database in plain text. And Telegram has access to that. Telegram is also owned by Russians. So if you're in the Ukraine right now and you've been using Telegram thinking that your messages were protected, you should be really careful. I would encourage everyone to use Signal, for example. It's heralded as the most private messaging app out there. Places like Freedom of the Press Foundation say that this is, the only one that we would really endorse. There are some others that I think are great. Signal is really a very solid product that I would encourage people to use. Think of it this way. A lot of people think their email is private. They'll send emails. They're like, well, the person on the other end is the only one who has a copy of this. And that's just not the case. It's not even a fact that you have to be targeted for that email to be collected. That email is already collected as soon as you send it out. Email, the protocol by its nature, is insecure. And Gmail in particular, the government, the NSA, is vacuuming up everything on Google's servers. We know that through the Snowden revelations, through the PRISM program. So they have access to Google servers. They're just vacuuming all that stuff up. So I think that people can make small steps, like whenever you have something important to say, send it by encrypted chat with disappearing messages on Signal, and don't send it via email. That's going to go a long way to reducing the amount of data that's collected about you. There are lots of other things you can do. Just choose a better browser when you're searching the internet. Use something like Brave or choose a better search engine. Instead of using Google, use something like DuckDuckGo. All of these things actually go a tremendous way, and they're just small shifts that you can make in your daily actions.
Well, no doubt. And I would say if there's no other action item here for folks, after this episode is over, definitely start using Signal. That's the easiest one of all. It's just an app. You can get it, install it, no problem. And it's immediately intuitive how to use it. It's just like a text messaging app. It's just like the text messages you've always been sending. But now you'll have this satisfied smirk on your face as you're using it. I've been using it for quite a while now. I think I even sent them a little donation because I thought, why not? I appreciate what you're doing. So it's great. It's great. And it required basically no modification of my lifestyle, no major investment of time, no learning curve. So there's really no reason not to use it.
Yeah, no, it's such a great way to start off your privacy journey. You know, start with Signal and then start exploring different alternatives. The products that you're using, if it's like a Google or a Facebook or whatever, just understand that those products, by their nature, they're data collecting machines. That's what their business model is based on. So you can just start to switch out those services for other products. Use ones that are a little more private. And I've made the transition in my life for almost all of these products. And my life is much better for it because I feel really nice that my data isn't, so much data isn't being collected about me. Now, obviously, there are two different types of privacy. There's extreme privacy. And if you want absolute privacy, because I hear this all the time, people say like, nothing you do on the internet is safe. Therefore, I'm not even going to care about it. I'm just going to let it all go. And I think that's the wrong attitude. You can take small steps that go a really long way to protecting yourself and reducing the amount of data out there. So I think that, I mean, it's really easy to do these things. So you absolutely should. And extreme privacy is necessary if you're a targeted individual. If you're someone like Snowden, then yeah, you want to be looking at extreme privacy and go down that rabbit hole. But for the average person, practical privacy is achievable and it's not even that difficult. I think people just, there's not much education about this. People aren't aware of lots of alternatives to Google products, for example. But there are lots of ways that you could even use YouTube without using Google. There are alternatives that basically mirror YouTube's website and you don't have to go through a YouTube link. You could watch videos on Odyssey, which is a completely decentralized system. I'm on Odyssey. John Stossel's on Odyssey. You know, like there are lots of people who are on Odyssey. And I think that it's a great way to start to change your behavior in small ways that can make a huge impact on your life.
One of my listeners created a website called datahound.net. And all it is a place for people who are searching for alternatives to see what the alternatives are. So he's got alternatives to Facebook, Google, Chrome, YouTube, text messaging, crowdfunding services, you know, and many other types of services. And for each one, he's even got alternatives to Wikipedia. For each one, he has multiple options that you can look into. So you can find something that works for you. So, and that he's just offering that as a service to mankind. So I appreciate that. Tell folks what you're up to these days and how they can follow your work.
Yeah, so I have a YouTube channel, has 118,000 subscribers at the moment, and we put out videos about privacy and about cryptocurrency. Our catchphrase is your money, your data, your life. So it's all tools to help you reclaim areas of your life, whether it's your data, your money, or other things. So people can find me at Naomi Brockwell TV on YouTube. They can find me at Naomi Brockwell on Twitter. I'm on Odyssey. If you look for Naomi Brockwell, you'll find me there as well. And we put out a weekly newsletter as well. So that has a lot of different news bits to be aware of throughout the week. We also do two live shows a week as well. So we do one on privacy each week and one on cryptocurrency each week. So lots of information out there and ways for you to get in contact.
Wow, you keep busy. Good for you.
So I'm too busy worrying about my privacy to sleep, Tom. That's the reality of it.
Well, I'm glad you're sharing what you know with the world and with my folks. So I'll link to all this on our show notes page. So I appreciate your time so much today, Naomi. Best of luck with all you're doing.
Thanks so much, Tom. Great chatting with you.
All right, everybody, find out more about Naomi Brockwell at tomwoods.com/2075. Coming up over the next couple of days, our old friend Pete Quinones returns to the show. Then also our old friend Germinal G. Van is back with another book. He just turned 32 years old and he's just released his 22nd book. That is not a joke. You may remember him from last time, but this one features a foreword by your host here. The book is called The Economic Policy of Thomas Jefferson, a historical analysis. So he asked me to write the foreword. I did that. The book is released. In the time it took me to write the foreword, he probably wrote two or three more books. So we're going to do a little bit of economic history. So I'm going to try my best to bring back more topics because I spent so much time on the virus stuff, and that's still important. And there's still craziness that is coming out of that. And there are still countries with crazy restrictions, even as various restrictions in the U.S. are coming off. Even New York City has dropped its vaccine passport system, which seemed like they were going to keep forever. So things are changing rapidly. But I got faked out last time. I thought it was coming to an end. And so I pivoted and then it came right on back. But there's just so many other things we need to talk about that are important or other dangers we need to analyze. So I'm going to be doing a lot more of that lately. And of course, those of you who listen on YouTube, you'll notice that you're missing about 18 episodes. Well, I just have had no choice. I've had no choice. So that's why you should listen on Odyssey. If you absolutely want to listen on a video platform, listen on Odyssey. TomWoods.com/vid, and you'll find all the episodes you missed. And there were some great ones, but YouTube keeps penalizing me and they're trying to take my channel away. So I just, for the most part, have stopped posting on YouTube, at least for the time being. So if you're wondering what's going on, that's what's going on. If you were on my newsletter list, you would know that was what was going on. So I really, really do need you to be on that mailing list because if disaster strikes, I need to be able to contact you. If they take my channel away, there's no way I can reach all those people anymore. It's gone. So hop on my list. You won't be sorry you did because the whole libertarian world talks about it. And you can do that, TomWoods.com, top of the page. You'll see it. Sign me up. Just click that sign me up button. Turn your ad blocker off so you can sign yourself up, and then you'll get the old Tom Woods letter. All right. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.